website is womenprisoners.org. Ladies, thank you so, so much. I should have taken the whole hour for you. All right. Well, we'll
thank
talk
you.
Again. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jerry.
KPFK, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On the eve of the third anniversary of Russia's brutal war on Ukraine, global politics have taken a stunning turn, with Trump's administration engaging in so-called peace talks that exclude Ukraine entirely, the geopolitical stakes have never been higher. As Trump embraces Putin's revisionist narrative, outrageously claiming Ukraine started the war, Ukraine finds itself not only fighting Russian aggression, but now also facing an historic betrayal from its most important ally. What does this mean for Ukraine's survival, Europe's stability, and the broader left struggle against imperialism and authoritarianism? To unpack this rapidly shifting landscape, we welcome two incisive voices. Zakhar Popovich, a Ukrainian researcher and activist in Kyiv with deep roots in labor and socialist organizing, and Ilya Budryatskis, a Russian historian and political theorist now in exile. Together, they analyze the implications of Trump's concessions to Putin, the resilience of Ukraine, and the urgent need for the international left to rethink its stance in an era of resurgent imperialism and incipient fascism. Stay with us for a vital conversation on war, resistance, and the future of democracy in a world tilting toward authoritarian rule. We'll also ask for your support when our program returns in just a moment. Hello, everyone. This is Susie Wiseman, and I'm here to ask for your support and your sponsorship of this program, Beneath the Surface, and this station, KPFK. We're here during the fund drive, and this is the time when we ask you listeners to support the radio station. And I should say sponsor it because it's a listener-sponsored radio station. And if you value the kind of programming that I've been bringing to you for more than 40 years, I'm going to ask you to please put your money where your ears are and go to your phones and call up at 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK or go online to www.kpfk.org and pledge your support. It costs money to keep free speech radio on the air. We don't have commercials. It's not a commercial station. And we don't sell your data anywhere, but we do ask you way too much, in fact, to cough up support for the radio station. And I'm asking you to do that now. I try consistently to bring you the best voices on the hottest topics. And I specialize in covering Russia, the former Soviet Union, experiments in social change, labor, and the economy. And I put a lot of time and effort into the shows, and we don't come to you that often to ask for you to support that effort. We're all volunteers. None of us are paid. And I've had a pretty bad year in terms of health, so I haven't been here as many times as I would have liked to. But all is looking up now, and I'm asking you for your support at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Please dig deep into your pockets and give all you can. If you make a donation to KPFK in this February fund drive, a portion of the donation will go to rebuilding and recovery efforts to those who've lost their homes in recent California wildfires. Levels can vary: $60, $75, $100, $500, $1,000. Habitat for Humanity Los Angeles will receive a portion of your donation to KPFK. The more you give, the more we can help the people right now who are suffering from the effects of the recent devastating California wildfires. You make the decision on how much you can give. Every dollar is greatly appreciated. Please call us now at 818-985-5735. Thank you so much. I appreciate your listenership, and thank you for supporting this program and this radio. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, and we're on the eve of the third anniversary of Russia's brutal war in Ukraine. That's for on February 24th. And everything is somersaulted in the last several days as the new Trump administration has held so-called peace talks in Saudi Arabia with Russia, excluding Ukraine. Once again, Ukraine has no agency. Trump's form of negotiation is not a negotiation per se. He is acceding to Putin's view of the war, even insisting now that Ukraine began the war and Zelensky is a dictator, and insists that the phrase Russian aggression may not be used in the G7 Ukraine statement. Putin has to be happy. In 3 years of Russia's brutal onslaught, it hasn't won much, a sliver of land, while hundreds of thousands have been killed and or maimed. Ukrainian cities have been reduced to rubble and destroyed. Trump is saving Putin and selling out Ukraine in one of history's biggest betrayals. Trump's art of the deal is to concede and call it a win because he gets to say he ended the war. Putin is playing Trump, singing victory at home. What does Trump and the U.S. get? Trump has demanded control over Ukraine's critical minerals or rare earths, as he says. But the $500 million payback includes everything from ports and infrastructure to oil and gas. The conservative British Telegraph concludes that the terms of the contract that landed at Zelensky's office a week ago amounts, in their words, to the U.S. economic colonization of Ukraine in legal perpetuity. It implies a burden of reparations that cannot possibly be achieved. We're very fortunate today to have Zakhar Popovich in Kyiv and Ilya Budzhaitskis with us to untangle this new reality. We're going to talk about the so-called negotiations, their implications for Ukraine and Europe, and the broader geopolitical stakes. Let me introduce my guest. Zakhar Popovich is a senior research fellow at the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine and head of the Foresight Institute for Political Economy, an NGO. His work focuses on economic and technological foresight, labor rights, and social justice. He was actively involved in the Maidan protests and has long been engaged in socialist organizing and advocacy for workers' rights in Ukraine. You can check out his articles, Russia's Road to Fascism and The View from the Ukrainian Left in Against the Current, and his other work in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And Ilya Budzhaitskis, who is a frequent guest on our show, is an historian, a political theorist, an activist, previously based in Moscow. He's currently a visiting scholar in UC Berkeley, soon to join the sociology department as a PhD candidate. He podcasts and conducts online classes, currently beginning one on the nature of fascism, and writes regularly for many publications, political and cultural websites. He was a founding member of the recently dissolved Russian Socialist Movement. And his 2022 book, published by Verso, called Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia, was shortlisted for the Deutscher Prize. Ilya's forthcoming book, co-authored with Ilya Medvedev, is Russia's New Imperialism, Capital, and Ideology. Welcome to both of you, and after all of that, I'm really pleased to have you here. Let's begin with these so-called Trump-Putin negotiations and their implications for Ukraine and Europe, and also the broader geopolitical stakes, as I mentioned. And let's start with Zakhar about your view of this so-called negotiation or talk and what you think the likely outcome will be.
I would say that, of course, we expected something bad from new American president, but we were shocked in Ukraine to the extent which this kind of 18th century imperialist approach is pushed. And so it's not easy for me kind of make any forecasts of how it will end. I can't see any signs of peace. So, in fact, nothing much changed in Ukraine, you know. We have regular air alarms. Actually, one air alarm just started a couple of minutes ago. So it could be some other bombing of Kyiv tonight, as it happened regularly. But, you know, it's just day to day, and it's not producing too much actually damage. If you said that Ukrainian cities are reduced to rubble, some, you know, small and medium-sized cities on the front line are really, really destroyed heavily. But, you know, most of Ukrainian cities are still more or less functioning as usual, you know. And it's very, very hard for me to make any forecasts. What I can say is that, you know, probably Ukraine will try to wage this war and will not surrender soon, you know. At least much larger pressure will be needed on Ukrainian government and society to make Ukraine surrender.
No, that's a very good as a beginning. And I probably should have said, too, that, you know, we're moving into a new geopolitical configuration. And of course, Russia's invasion of Ukraine changed the trajectory of the century. And so that the 21st century, as it continues now, a quarter of the way in, is looking more and more like the 20th century in so many ways. You know, after I saw these talks, I thought, Jesus, is the division of Poland next, you know, in terms of inching toward a new world war. But I think we have to be slightly comforted by the fact that we know that Trump doesn't have a lot of staying power and is often incompetent. But Ilya, let's move to your view of what's going on. You wrote a very interesting post on Trump's art of the deal, so-called. But let's get your view of what's going on right now.
So the first thing about these negotiations is that there is no exact agenda behind these negotiations. So what Lavrov and Rubio discussed in Saudi Arabia were mostly some general talks about restoration of the full diplomatic relations, so nothing more. And it seems that there is no exact plan how to end the war and how to bring sustainable peace to Ukraine from Trump's administration. So basically, we don't know nothing about his actual proposal. But on the Russian side, you see that so-called initial goals of the special military operation started by Putin 3 years ago remains unchanged. So there are still declarations that all Ukraine should be maybe not conquered military, but put under Russian control as a country. So Ukraine is an artificial state, it should not exist. So here we see no changes at all and no signs of compromises from the Russian side. So that's why these peace talks are so strange, because there is no ground and no agenda for such talks. So now it looks like confirmation of all Putin's story about the reasons of this invasion from side of Trump's administration.
And I think that's exactly right. And one has to stress yet again that Ukraine has been winning this war. As it drags on and on, there is a lot of attrition and it's being difficult for Ukraine. But so long as it had the support of Europe and the United States, it can continue. And now, of course, if the United States switches side, which it's attempting to do in some way, it looks like that may change. But for the moment, I think it's important that both of you have stressed that the situation is unchanged. Some of the things that we had hoped for with the end of the war would be not only Ukraine's, you know, sovereignty and independence, but also implications for whether or not Putin can continue in his militarization and threats to his former near abroad, as we're seeing. That, I think, is still up in the air. But Let's go to Zachar, because you started to talk, I think, a little bit in an email with me about the dangerous consequences of any attempt to pressure Ukraine into an unfavorable agreement. And I'd just like to say for our listeners that when Ukraine became an independent state at the time of the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Ukraine had the third largest nuclear arsenal of any state in the world. And it demilitarized and was taken out. And many at the time, me included, thought that this was, you know, a good sign that Ukraine wanted to signal that it was not in favor of nuclear weapons and would withdraw from the threat of nuclear war. Now, I wonder if you think that so-called Budapest Memorandum looks any different when we're contemplating what the new political configuration is in that part of the world. Let's start with you, Zachar.
Yeah, Ukraine is a little bit different from most of the countries that Trump is trying to push, some Latin America's countries, so on. And Ukraine is, you know, still has a very significant industrial potential, you know, technological potential and scientific potential. And our country still has a, you know, huge nuclear power industry. Yeah, and a very significant military industrial complex and so on. We're very highly dependent on American aid and on European aid. But still, I hope that this situation with this Trump offensive behavior towards Zelensky and towards Ukraine, you know, many people will understand that Ukraine is not just a proxy of some other imperialist. Global implications, of course, could be very, very bad, I think, that really we see that the rules are changing in the world. Yes, the rules are changing and all, you know, the Ukrainian identity to some extent was built on this Budapest Memorandum. Yeah, that we are the, you know, big European country with huge nuclear arsenal and we gave it up because we believe in the world where big countries respect borders, respect independence, respect international institutions, and our borders are guaranteed by United States, Europe, and Russia. So it was shock for Ukraine that just these rules are not working anymore. It was 10 years ago. Yes, it was in 2014. And the next shock was that, you know, Russia can just invade full scale. But, you know, of course, it was things that we are experiencing. Probably for Americans, it was, you know, kind of too far country, have a little implications over the United States. But I think it will have implications now. And It's really making the world where the imperialist powers can decide about their spheres of influence, can, you know, press any independent countries in the agreements, like selling all the, just all together, wholesale, all your natural resources for some, you know, small promises of possible security guarantees, which are still not guaranteed, but, you know, just declared. Of course, world is moving towards the new inter-imperialist war. No. 10 years ago, I was saying these kind of alarmist things, but now I see that this is, you know, unfortunately, the most probable way, directory of move, especially if it will end with the surrender and partition of Ukraine. It will open the door for other partitioning of other countries and spheres of influence.
Ilya, let's get your view on this, you know, because I think Zachar is right to talk about this looming inter-imperialist conflict as he's described it. And you've just written a book that's really addressing a lot of this issue, especially in terms of the imperialist ideology of Putin and his actions. In each case, I think stunning, shocking are the terms that we would use, because Putin has certainly morphed from where he was when he entered into power and has accrued more and more wealth and power, become more and more authoritarian and repressive. And now it's something that's quite attractive to Trump, although it's so new right now and so stunning, we haven't yet seen the reaction, enough of the reaction of the American political establishment, although certain Republicans who've always been opposed to Russia, anti-communist to the hilt, now are starting to say, well, wait a second, you know, we're not going to ally with Russia. And of course, Trump thinks he's being incredibly clever as pushing this as a way to split Russia from China. There's a lot of geopolitical issues that I just brought up, but I want to get your view from what you think Putin is doing here.
Actually, the main thesis of our book is, yes, that we are coming in the new era of imperialist rivalries, imperialist redistribution of the world. And that's why we need to think again about the very definition of imperialism, because imperialism always had like two dimensions. So one is economical, and the other dimension is political, territorial, and ideological. So if we look back to the classic imperialism of the late 19th, early 20th century, we can see that it was not driven only by economic interest. It was driven also by the idea of expansion, of political and territorial and military expansion. You can say that all like imperialist, colonialist redistribution of Africa, for example, was only about new markets. It was also about the strengths of the imperial state, and it was about some exact worldview, some exact imperialist ideology. And in this sense, Putin, with his view that he presented in the very beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, somehow became a pioneer of this view in the modern world. So he introduced this idea of the empire, that this aim to conquer other countries, to broaden the borders of your own country is a kind of legitimate view on the world today. And I think that this view became somehow adopted even by some parts of American elites. If you are talking about this war from the Russian side as driven by economic interest, you definitely can see the limits of this explanation, because Russia became weaker during this 3 years right. Of war. I think that this very worldview of Russia as the empire which has strengthened its sovereignty through the territorial expansion is still there. It's very much inherited by the whole state apparatus. And that's why on one side, Putin needs some kind of break, because he need to rebuild army. But I think that the idea of the territorial expansion, of the restoration of Russian influence in the post-Soviet space, in the Eastern Europe, already became important idea that unified the whole state apparatuses of Russia today. And that's why I'm still quite skeptical about the outcomes of this peace negotiations, because this worldview could not be so easily changed by restoration of diplomatic ties with United States and by recognition of Putin as a great leader and Russia as a great power only by words. And that's what we exactly see by now.
Thank you for that. That's really encouraging. And of course, good to be reminded of, too, is that how big of losses, human, military, and political, for Russia this war has meant, not to mention the thousands who have been silenced or imprisoned or forced into exile for uttering anti-war stances or even accidentally doing so. Being opposed to the war is something that you're not allowed to discuss. And we would hope that if there was a real negotiation, that it would also include you know, the release of all political prisoners. But that's the next step. Let's go to Zachar now to get your ideas on this. I know that in our initial conversation over email, you talked about what does this mean for the Ukrainian left and for the world left, this kind of a negotiation? What kind of anti-imperialism do we talk about, especially given, let's say, how awful it's been, how much the war in Ukraine has divided much of the left? But I'd like to hear your views on first on where you think this is going to go next in terms of Ukraine. Do you agree with Ilya that this is so far words that cannot be backed up because of the state of Russia? And where is Europe in all of this? I just kind of like to get your overall view.
Well, situation in Ukraine is very uncertain. We can be certain that the war will last for some time, but nobody knows the outcome of this war. What I know that if the help will be withdrawn from Ukraine, Ukraine will probably survive huge losses. And I don't know if we will be capable to struggle alone against Russian imperialism, but we will. Country will not just surrender in 3 days. It's not how it works. So the much help Ukraine will receive, probably the less bloody the situation will continue. But of course, you know, we have active war, and you know, some thousands of people are being, you know, killed or injured every day. And it's also, it can't last forever. Yes, probably this offensive behavior by American president, you know, push Ukrainians to some consolidation around their leadership. Even people who don't like Zelensky for a moment, you know, decided to protect him, because it's kind of our president. Maybe it's bad, but we elected him, you know. But it will not also last for long. And also, we were always talking about the kind of neoliberal Ukrainian government. You know, but it's not that neoliberal after 3 years of war. No, it is moving step by step to more and more state involvement in the industry, implementing some industrial policy, developing some production, developing some new forms of social protection for displaced persons, for veterans, and so on. So Ukrainian state is changing and quietly abandoning neoliberalism, as some experts say. The only problem is that this kind of consciousness of need of some social state, of some industry, of some need of maintaining this social contract. It's Ukrainian bourgeoisie is very slow in understanding the necessity of this for building a sustainable state. But it is moving, you know. I don't know if we will have enough time, you know, to fully mobilize the resources of society to fight against this the Russian aggression. But still, you know, country is moving towards the consolidation and using as much of own resources as possible. You know, but it's still, it will be a total war with big losses. And also, you know, talking about the world left. So I see that probably, I hope so, that you know, international left is moving towards the understanding of what is going on, that it is not just, you know, some Western imperialist trying to, you know, encircle Russia. So it's a new inter-imperialist conflict unfolding, and the agenda of international left should be changed. You know, we should see that the world is moving towards a inter-imperialist war, and in many countries we see the development of this ideology of far-right ideology, you know, new faces of fascism, as Traverso put it. And, you know, see Germany, AfD is probably will be one of the largest parties in Bundestag. Yeah, of course, you know, last week's hearing from Trump and Musk and all new leaders of United States, you know, will open our eyes. Yeah. So unfortunately, not only Russia, but world is moving towards fascization, you know, in many senses. And the international left is moving towards forming the opposition to this. But, you know, unfortunately, it's moving very slow.
If I could just come in on that, you know, because the international left is weak. It has been weak for the longest time. But I think what has divided some of the left and some of those who I call the so-called left on this issue is that there's some sort of nostalgia about what the Soviet Union represented when it didn't. And that there's, especially in America, it's very prominent to have the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of ideology. And they, you know, cloak it in having a peace outlook. We can't side with Ukraine against Russia. But on the other hand, Ukraine, you know, has represented, as you just said, it's not so much neoliberal. I mean, in the post-Soviet period, Ukraine was an economic basket case and was a playground for its oligarchy, but it has moved since then. And the Zelensky presidency seemed like a breath of fresh air in that regard, at least, you know, helping to develop. Where, you know, the left has been very critical. I can see that. And for good reason. But one reason I think to support Ukraine in this battle is not that it's just fighting Russian aggression, the words that they're no longer going to be allowed to use, and for its own sovereignty, for its own state. But it also represented at least democratic values against authoritarianism. And that's worth supporting more and more as we see what you've just discussed about, you know, Germany, Italy, the U.S., so much of the world, Hungary, especially Russia. And as we're speaking, and it's very depressing looking at, you know, how this is shaping up and should it devolve into some kind of beginning of a world war in this sense, then I would see Ukraine sort of as like Spain in the 1930s. And it may be attractive for young leftists to help concretely in the fight against, you know, this new imperial aggression. Ilya, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, I totally agree with you and Zahar. And I would add that the main problem of the left today, Western left in particular, that they are totally retroactive. Yes, so their reactions are very much based on historical examples of 100 years ago. So as you mentioned, so many American lefts, they still thinking in the categories of the Cold War or some imperialist redistribution of the world 100 years ago. That's why they're completely not able to catch the current situation and to predict its development. And actually, that is very different from the socialists in the early 20th century, where the very concept of imperialism was developed firstly by Marxists. So they proposed the vision of the world, the analysis of the current capitalism that predict the coming World War I. And now we can see that the left, they are moving in their analysis and their understanding of the global political situation very slow. Yeah, and that's why they probably until recently believed honestly that, let's say, liberal democracy is something given, that it's the only form of neoliberal capitalism today, and they probably prepare to exist under such conditions for some more decades. And now this view is totally ruined, and now they have to find themselves in the totally new situation and do it very fast. That's why the question of Ukraine, and that is very important to understand, at least on the third year of this bloody war, is not just a question of containment of Russia or whatever, some provoked reaction of Putin toward the enlargement of NATO or any other explanation. They are not completely relevant for a current situation. So they have to understand finally that the question of Ukraine is one of the central questions of how the capitalist world would develop now. And in this sense, the question of Palestine, the question of Ukraine, they're not isolated. They are very much interrelated, and they could give you a signal of the general development of the current global capitalism towards the new forms of authoritarianism and imperialist ready division of the world.
I'd like to extend this conversation, Zachar, with your input as well, because we've talked a little bit about the left. Left organization is weak everywhere, but left sentiment is very strong. You know, we've never had as big an anti-capitalist sentiment in the United States. It's certainly present in most of Europe. Now, I'd like to get a sense from both of you about the respective left in your country. It's repressed in Russia, terribly repressed, but it exists. And has a future, I hope. And Zachar, I'd like to hear more from you about Ukraine and the left and the position that it's been put in because of the war, with so many people on the left actively fighting, certainly fighting against Russian aggression, not necessarily knowing what it is fighting for, other than, you know, the right of self-determination and the right of Ukraine to exist as a state. Can you give us a little overview of left sentiment and left activity in Ukraine?
I can, of course, but you should understand that, unfortunately, also significant part of left in Ukraine from 90s was part of, you know, Soviet nostalgia. There was a big parties like Communist Party of Ukraine, Socialist Party of Ukraine, which were built on this idea of Soviet nostalgia, Soviet Union, it was better social protection and so on. And this Soviet nostalgia made them, unfortunately, very dependent on the Russian ties with Russian left. Sorry, Ilya could probably correct me, but of course, in Russia, you have also this Communist Party of Russian Federation, which always use left slogans, you know, to some extent, was advocating the social justice and so on, so on. But still was very imperialist in its attitude towards other countries in the sphere of influence of Russia and so on. And during the Euromaidan, the Communist Party actually supported the Viktor Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, who actually fled out of the country to Russia. And it was very shameful, you know, betrayal. Before 1914, Communist Party was very significant. It had a very significant fraction in parliament. But, you know, it was discredited so much that it virtually vanished. Yeah. And we have these laws prohibiting Soviet and Nazi symbolics, which effectively, of course, more used against any kind of symbols of Soviet Union and so on. So Ukrainian left is re-emerging and rebuilding to some extent. It is weak, yeah. We have quite a significant trade union movement in Ukraine. And many of these trade unionists, they are people of at least a social democratic and frequently of socialist views. It's important structural part of Ukrainian civil society. And we have some leftist organizations, which are weak. What I can say is that, you know, some American leftist visited Ukraine some time ago and say that, well, probably Ukrainian left is weak, but American is even weaker. I don't know exactly. At least we have some networks of socialist activists, some networks of anarchist activists. And of course, many of trade unionists, many of anarchists, many of socialists, they are members of Ukrainian armed forces, and much part of activities of unions and of these organizations is to support their members in military, to organize some support for displacement persons and so on. But also it is important, of course, to push towards some attempts to reduce the rights of the unions, to reduce some social protection and so on. But at least we have some kind of discussion and we have some kind of politics and around these different reforms. But generally, you know, situation in the country is bad because it is war and situation is unclear. And all these institutions are working, but nobody knows how long it lasts.
And I'm sure it's quite demoralized by this recent turn of events with the stunning reversal of the U.S. position from being the strongest backer to now with Trump essentially changing sides. We still don't know how that's going to turn out. But Ilya, let's talk a little bit about the situation in Russia, because, of course, as you know, you and I have talked about the repression of political prisoners, about the case of Boris Kagarlitsky and many, many, many others in Russia, that Putin has managed to silence the left but not obliterate it. You know, we've always thought of the Putin regime as essentially weak in that regard, that it has to rely on repression to be able to continue. And the repression has gotten stronger. Do you see this current situation? You said you're not sure how it's going to turn out, but do you see this, let's say, undermining whatever opposition exists in Russia and, you know, strengthening Putin's hand in a very important way?
You know, probably I will slightly disagree that the high level of repressions in Russia somehow express the weakness of political apparatuses and of Putin's power, because these repressions, of course, the scale is quite high, and now you have at least hundreds of political prisoners in Russia. But still, the nature of these repressions is quite selective. And the aim of these repressions is more to educate the society in the right way, in that way that any public expression of your dissatisfaction, not just with the war, but with any aspect of Putin's regime is not allowed. And in this sense, this role of repressions is quite effective. So it's working. Yeah, I think for now, it's very hard to say that you have any sort of opposition in Russia. You have some probably a huge dissatisfaction in the Russian society, especially with the fact that war is ongoing, and Russia lost already more than 200,000 people there. So it's the biggest number since the Second World War. So of course you have some hidden dissatisfaction, some growing sentiments that we need peace to be restored in one way or another. But all this dissatisfaction could not reflect in any political forms. And it could not affect the policy of the current Russian leadership. That's why the situation in Russia is very sad in the way that this is the model where I believe many other countries, including United States, could go and go in by now. The situation where all elements, not just of representative democracy, but even basic civil liberties as the right for free speech are completely destroyed. And people are already trained, you know, in this new state of society. That's why any expression in political forms of this dissatisfaction could come with some cracks in the construction, in the political construction of this regime. And these cracks could appear only if Putin will fail with achieving the goals of so-called special military operation. That could provoke some split inside Russian state elites, inside business elites, and that could give a way for this mass sentiments to come to a public scene. But for now, unfortunately, we have the full authoritarian dictatorship already installed. And as we know from history, society could confirm with such kind of condition.
Pretty bleak. And maybe we should just talk in the last moments about what you're hoping for in terms of Ukraine, beginning with you, Zakhar, and also like what role for the international left, what you're hoping to see from Europe, what kind of reaction against Trump's new betrayal of Ukraine. How do you see it symbolically and concretely?
Well, I hope the new Russian revolution, it would be the best option for Ukraine and for Russia. But, you know, as Ilya said me, it's not that probable immediately, at least. But yeah, it would be the best, I think. Yeah. And I also hope that Ukraine will use this opportunity, actually, by this war, to recognize that, you know, we should have democratical social country with responsibility of all the businesses and with the voice of the working people heard. I hope that it is possible, and it is actually the only option of Ukrainian society to really consolidate enough to protect itself from the aggression. And of course, I hope that at least all European left will be united in helping Ukraine and in opposing Russian imperialism very strictly. This is what I am hoping.
Well, I think ultimately what you say is exactly right. We're all hoping for the revolution as the solution. And, you know, people think that it wasn't that far away. Of course, you know, you can have various views on that. But in the interim, you know, we have a situation where NATO, which was a moribund organization because of the end of the Cold War and has now become a sort of truly defensive organization that countries want to join to protect themselves from Russia. And it is pledging to support Ukraine. It puts the left even in a kind of a difficult situation for some, for those who are nostalgic for the old situation that no longer pertains, but not at all if you really want to, you know, see the world, I guess, as you are both saying, that the existence of Ukraine, or let's say the survival of Ukraine, is a critical existential task, I guess, for the world to take on to halt this march of Russia and Russian form of authoritarianism that you've both indicated is gaining hold, not just in Russia. So, Ilya, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I could just share this hope for the next Russian revolution. And if we remember the revolution of 1917, it was, revolution that started in February 1917, it was what Rosa Luxemburg called the revolution in unusual place. So Russia in that time was the last place in the world where revolution was imaginable, and it happened. And it was unexpected for everyone, including all the revolutionary parties, including Bolshevik party. So in this way, I hope that Russia is still able to produce such miracles. But I should say that we can't rely only on miracles. So we should rely on ourselves, on our small forces as the international left. And I think now is a very important point when the left in United States should realize that Putin is not like unique Russian story. It's not the kind of case that inherited in some particular Russian history. It's the part of the global trend. This trend is already presented in United States. And in this sense, we have a common enemy that we should resist together as Ukrainians, as American trade unionists, as Russian socialists, as Palestinians. I mean, we have a global enemy, very dangerous, which is very powerful, but that's the situation that we have for the moment.
Just as we're ending, I'd like to say, and the Cold War did a lot of damage to the very concept of socialism, but at its heart, it's the struggle for complete democracy. And that, you know, as distorted as the Soviet Union was, and it was, the revolution itself began that way, as something that was spontaneous and from below. And at the heart of the whole enterprise of Marxism and of socialism is this concept that we must struggle to have a form of democracy that is complete and genuine and not, you know, top down, represent, you know, all of those things. And I think that, you know, that will be the clarion call in these new struggles, that we have to not just protect the democratic structures that we once had, but extend them and extend their meaning. And in that light, you know, perhaps we'll see Ukraine as a kind of vanguard in this struggle. The situation for Russia in the 21st century is quite different than what it was at the beginning of the 20th century. We shouldn't forget, you said that the revolution was a surprise for everyone, including the Bolsheviks. And Lenin famously said it is a terrible thing that the honor of beginning the socialist revolution in the world should befall to backward Russia. And in terms of world importance for socialism, the German Revolution is more important, the English, the French, all of those. And if need be, Russia should sacrifice its revolution to assist theirs. People forget that there was this internationalist understanding of what socialism would be and that it was a nearly impossible task to get to socialism in Russia. That's a historical debate with a lot of relevance. So let's just end out. Let me hear from each of you your hopes and I guess your assessment of what you think is going to happen in the weeks to come. I would start with you, Zahar.
You raised too many questions, you know.
Okay, so just your thoughts.
I can say that, yes, we should struggle for democracy and for kind of other understanding of democracy. You hear this speech by DJ Vance in Munich about the democracy. And it's
glad
totally
you brought that up.
Other understanding of democracy from my head. You know, they explicitly exclude significant part of people from the democracy. Yeah, they exclude all the migrants. They don't have a vote. And trying to maintain, you know, these countries that actually exploit all other world and do not give any voice to other people in the world. So we need democracy for everybody, make democracy for all, and we need global democracy. Democracy is not working in one separate country, no. This is probably the main outcome. I hope that this offensive towards democracy and towards the understanding of human rights that is waging by Mr. Trump and Mr. Musk and all these people, you know, it can maybe it triggers some reaction all over the world among many left progressive forces to join forces for real global democracy, you know. And, you know, a lot should be done to build this.
Thank you. And I apologize for throwing so many questions toward you in that regard. Ilya, let's hear your last thoughts.
Yeah, so probably I will focus only of you know, some short-term prognosis, what will happen in coming months.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm a bit skeptical about the outcomes of these so-called peace talks, because, of course, Putin is ready to use this Trump situation, where Trump is trying to get any peace restored in a very short period of time to present it as his own achievement, his own victory. And Putin, I think he clearly understands that Putin has no exact plan. And that's why he will try to get as much as possible in this short period of time, because that's the only chance for him that could be missed quite soon. And the question is if Trump will be ready to give everything that Putin wants just to get his imaginable Nobel Prize, or he will bring some conditions to the table. And of course, these conditions, this prize for Ukraine should be, as you mentioned, some distance from China, which is very hard to manage by now in the situation where Russian economy is totally dependent on Chinese export, on Chinese economy in general. So I don't think that this kind of immediate shift of the Russian policy would be possible. So that's why I'm skeptical about this. And I think that this warm friendship between Putin and Trump could be challenged in the very foreseeable future.
I want to thank both of you for this extended conversation. There's still a lot more to be said, and I want to call on you again to bring you back and have more of your ideas as things evolve. And just tell the listeners to go out and, you know, Google both of them, Zakhar Popovich, who is in Kyiv, and you can see his articles in English in Against the Current, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Ilya Budryatskyi's book, forthcoming book coming out, we don't know exactly when, it is The New Imperialism. Is that the title of it?
Yeah, it's a working title.
Yeah, Russia's New Imperialism, we'll see what it is, and also pick up his book and his article, his book Dissidents Among Dissidents, and many articles that you can find. Thank you to both of you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much, Zakhar.
Hello everyone, this is Susie Wiseman, and I'm here to ask for your support and your sponsorship of this program, Beneath the Surface, and this station, KPFK. We're here during the fund drive, and this is the time when we ask you listeners to support the radio station, and I should say sponsor it because it's a listener-sponsored radio station. And if you value the kind of programming that I've been bringing to you for more than 40 years, I'm going to ask you to please put your money where your ears are and go to your phones and call up at 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK or go online to www.kpfk.org and pledge your support. It costs money to keep free speech radio on the air. I try consistently to bring you the best voices on the hottest topics, and I specialize in covering Russia, the former Soviet Union, experiments in social change, labor, and the economy. And I put a lot of time and effort into the shows, and we don't come to you that often to ask for you to support that effort. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Please dig deep into your pockets and give all you can. If you make a donation to KPFK in this February fund drive, a portion of the donation will go to rebuilding and recovery efforts to those who've lost their homes in recent California wildfires. Levels can vary: $60, $75, $100, $500, $1,000. Habitat for Humanity Los Angeles will receive a portion of your donation to KPFK. The more you give, the more we can help the people right now who are suffering from the effects of the recent devastating California wildfires. You make the decision on how much you can give. Every dollar is greatly appreciated. Please call us now at 818-985-5735. Thank you so much. I appreciate your listenership, and thank you for supporting this program and this radio. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Zachar Popovich and Ilya Budraitskis. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Osman Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page, That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening and thanks for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
KPFK's Fund Drive is in full swing, and right now your station could really use your help.